Hello, so good morning. So today we're going to talk about ISAs, so instruction set architectures, which is the interface, the machine code interface that a machine provides. We're going to also talk in particular about the ISA that you'll be implementing this semester in later assignments. But we'll talk a bit about the variety of ISAs, and this is a very incomplete list of ISAs that you can buy chips for today. So there are, for most of these, multiple implementations, multiple microarchitectures implementing each of these ISAs. So it's not, the world is not just x86, which is what we learned before. There's a lot of other things going on. And presumably some reason why you'd use all these other things. So before I get to the meat of the material, some anonymous feedback. So there were a bunch of comments saying that, hey, the reading for today is section 4.1. Why is the quiz on sections 4.1 to 4.3? So I apologize that we apparently didn't make this clear enough. The pre-quiz for a week is on the entire week, just like the post-quiz for a week is on the entire week. So if you want to figure out what you should be reading for the pre-quiz, you need to look at both lectures. We separate out the reading across the two lectures, because that's a lot easier when you're like reviewing for a test and you want to figure out, hey, where in the book is this thing I didn't understand in lecture? But the pre-quiz for the week covers the entire week because we don't have a pre-quiz before each lecture. So I hope that's clear. Yeah, I had some questions about why is Professor Khan lecturing instead of Rice when he is in lecture in Lose List or whatever? So the idea behind splitting this up like this is that it should be worth less work for both of us doing the lecturing, which hopefully means it's better for you, that we put together better lectures as a result of not needing to be rushing at the last minute to put together every lecture. And also we need to stay in sync anyways. We're sharing labs and homeworks. If our lectures get out of sync, we're in real trouble for the labs. You know, that's not gonna be good. And yes, we're aware that some will like one of us more than the other. That's gonna happen. I did this last semester with Luther. This is probably not as good as with Luther because Luther and I have very different teaching styles, and Samira and I probably have less different teaching styles. But the hope is that it's useful to have two teachers and it's better for you. But we appreciate feedback, and obviously at the end of the semester we'll evaluate whether we want to keep doing this sort of thing again in the future. So some questions. Can we bring back the WebM recordings of the lectures? So when Samira has been using a different video format, and so I guess someone had problems with it, I'd like to know about technical issues with video. I'd note that changing it to like WebM or MP4 format, if that seems to work better for you, might not actually fix things because a lot matters like what program we use to make it. So I'd like to try to debug those issues. We can actually like transcode things, but that might not help. And in particular, the reason they're in the format they are is because this should be the highest quality version of the screen capture. If I converted everything to WebM format, which I might do, it's going to be lower quality because that's not what it was produced in originally. Question about, could we go over the quizzes the next day? So generally, I do not want to just automatically go over the quizzes. I will be happy to go over any questions you have on the quizzes at the beginning of class or elsewhere in class, but I'm not going to just automatically go over the quizzes. I don't think we have that much time throughout the semester. As for solutions, we would need to if you, I've scrutinized solutions, this person wants like worked out solutions. I don't know if we have the time to do that for every quiz. But we, if you ask, we will be glad to provide one. You know, like on Piazza or something, I will gladly give you a worked out why an answer for a quiz is that way. And speaking of quizzes, a specific complaint about the quiz for last week, the post-quiz, saying that Professor Khan fumbled their answer on flags. I'm not sure which lecture this is referring to. So we would appreciate knowing if you think we need to re-explain something like flags, which we will end up doing for other reasons. But I don't think that even if this was actually a problem, that affects the question in the quiz. So the question in the quiz was comparing CompQ and SubQ. And the thing you need to know was nothing about how flags are set, just that CompQ is SubQ except it doesn't store the results. That's all you needed to know for that question. You didn't actually need to know, you need to know that they both set flags, that's all you needed to know. You didn't need to know how the flags were set, whether SF or ZF got set in some circumstances. And then an inquiry about, could we spend 5 to 10 minutes going over string SF? Found it confusing, it is confusing. I'm not sure I want to spend 5 to 10 minutes on that, but let's look at it a bit. So string SF is about separating a string into pieces. So for example, if I want to divide this string, this is a test, by spaces, I'd like to get something like this, where I get each word separated by spaces. And string SF is meant to be used in some way like this to do it. So the first argument is a pointer which keeps track of where we are in this string. And the output is each token. And you might say, where does the memory for that token come from? And it's actually part of the string. So when string step iterates through the string, it adds backslash zeros. So we have a string this, which is the first thing which is printed out, this backslash zero. So that prints out as this, because the backslash zero terminates the string. And the second time we print out is, that's there's a backslash zero that replaces the space, that so it terminates the string. So we get a word as a separate string each time. Yes?
Might be a dumb question, but it seems like there's multiple words in a single word, quote unquote, but like, in which cases is it treated as separate words and one not?
What do you mean?
It's like one character pointer and like it's all the characters in a row, they're just separated by nulls, right?
Yeah.
By nulls.
So each call to string set is going, so the first call is going to, it's going to look at this pointer and it's going to find the first space. It's going to replace it with backslash zero and return the old value of the pointer. And that's going to effectively return the first token found after where that pointer originally pointed. And it updates the pointer to point right after there, so you can call it again and get the next thing.
Is there a function that like separates into multiple separate like words?
What
like a list, for example.
It gives you a list? No. So if you wanted to construct a list, you would need to use the token returned and actually do that. So here I'm not constructing, I'm just printing out each thing I get. Yes?
So if you kept, if for example in this case you'd run stir set like four times, right?
Yes. And the last time it will return null saying there's nothing left.
And so like if you were gonna separate an entire long sentence, you'd do while stir set not equal to null and then the entire thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Wait, so it returns a pointer to after the replacement, or?
Yeah.
Like, the pointer returns, where does it point
to? So the pointer it returns is the string that we output. So it's the word it found. It changes the pointer you pass in to point out, to point to the next place to start looking.
Oh. So like if you're running one, if you're running like one, the pointer would point to is.
Yeah.
To the beginning of the
I. Yeah. Okay. So that's the basic idea. The library function is actually a little different. The difference is that instead of taking a character here, it takes a string. But just looking for a single character is simpler, so we think you appreciate that.
So then it changes the actual pointer, but the thing it returns is the string that it just passed.
Yes, with the which has been except in the case where we're out of tokens, which and some other cases like that. So I didn't go through all the details, but the idea is that you can use this in sort of a loop like this. That's the sort of intuition you should have, and I hopefully didn't fumble this when I made it hastily last night.
So the point is that we're supposed to get us receiving a character array, and we're supposed to, using a delimiter, replace that delimiter with a backslash zero character and then just return that string?
So return that string and update where you look for the next delimiter. Update the pointer so you know where to look for the delimiter next. Okay. Any other questions on string set? Okay, and finally, so anonymous feedback asking a specific question about one of the bitwise operation quiz questions, which was that there was a question where the answer was that it finds powers of two, and someone thought that it didn't do that. So I think there was a misunderstanding, probably because of confusing what's a logical operator and what's a bitwise operator, and I think that's a good thing to go over, because it's a common confusion. So exclamation point, the thing you've used before in C, that's logical. You don't expect exclamation point when you give it 1 to return 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0. It's not bit by bit. It takes whether the value is true or false. The tilde operator is bitwise. And in the example we have, in the question we had this expression. So if you pass 6, that's 6 and 5, which is 4. Not 4 is 0. And that's used with double and. So that's logical, not bitwise. So it's saying 6 and 0 is 0. So, any questions on this? I think the confusion here, I'm not sure, was probably that someone thought that one of these two operators or both of them were bitwise, which is not true. So they were logical. So while this is bitwise, this and, this one just looks at whether things are true or false, and this exclamation point looks at whether things are true or false, not each bit. Yeah.
And if any bit is set in like a segment of bits, then it returns true, correct?
Yeah. So the question is, exclamation point returns true if any bit is set. So the rule is that 0 is the only false value. So if it's not 0, it returns true. Sorry, if it's not 0, it returns false, I should say. If it's not 0, it returns false. If it is, otherwise, all bits have to be 0 for it to return true. Because that's the only way you can represent 0. Okay. So that's all I have for anonymous feedback. And on other logistics things, there's a list homework. And I probably should go over the three types of lists that you might need to deal with in the homework. So the homework's going to have you write a function to convert between two of these types, and on the type you convert to append or remove elements that match something. And our three types are relatively simple. So we have a sentinel terminated array. So that's, we have a pointer that points to something terminated by a sentinel value. We will give you in this skeleton code the sentinel value you need to use. But there's a sentinel value at the end. This is just like C strings. C strings use a backslash 0. We're going to probably use something else because we have array of shorts, and 0 is a useful value to have in a list of shorts. The other is this thing that we use to imitate a vector, where we have a length and a pointer. So we have that pointer should be the thing pointing to that. But we have a pointer, we have a length and a pointer pointing to the list of things. And the other type is a linked list, which I hope you've seen before. Yeah?
Is it slightly more elegant in the second box to write size of short times x dot length?
Perhaps, yeah. You use this to emphasize that this and this are different. Yes?
If you malloc something for a list or like something, is there a way to like expand it without freeing and then allocating again?
There is, but you probably should just free and allocate. There is, it's called realloc. But in the worst case, realloc will free and allocate, so you need to handle that. Yeah.
Do null terminated strings fall under the sense of type of sentinel?
Yeah. So they're that type of thing. They use a different sentinel. That's the same idea. And one thing that commonly confuses people is what parts of these you malloc and what parts you don't. So the pointer to the sentinel terminated array is not malloced. It's on the stack or in a register. The range struct, that whole struct, is on the stack or in registers. Everything else is malloced. The pointer to the first element of your linked list is on the stack. each node you allocate is on the heap. It's malloced. And it's important to get this right because mallocing and freeing properly is part of the homework. Okay. Any questions about list homework? So this is after the lab this week that is in lab that you have to do. Okay. Okay, and one final piece of logistics. We have a final. Because we have two sections of the class, it is a combined final. We have obtained the 9 May 7 to 10 p.m. final slot. We will announce a location when we book a room. There will be a form for conflicts. If you have a conflict, please figure this out soon. We expect that we will have to give some on a conflicting time, probably the next day, which is a reading day. And this is on the schedule, so you can look it up there. So finally, any non-anonymous feedback? Yeah?
So we've already gone over one of the good-wise questions from the previous course.
Yeah.
Can you go over the other one?
Sure. So the question is, can I go over the other bitwise question? So let's see how quickly I can pull this up. So quizzes for this semester. Okay, so last week's post quiz, last week's post quiz, right. So you want to know about, presumably, this question.
Yep.
Okay, so the hint here should be very helpful. So it's telling you that zero, that minus one is all ones. So this means that if we take something which is 0 or 1, like this x less than y, because that's what logical things in C return is 0 or 1, and we negate it, we get minus 1, so we get all 1s or all 0s. So based on which is less, we either get all 1s here or all 0s. And that's going to determine whether or not we're XORing y with 0, because if this is all 0s, then this whole expression is 0s. Or we're XORing y with x, x, or y, which if you XOR something with something twice, you get back the original thing. And XOR is commutative and associative, like addition. So either this is going to return x or y, depending on whether this turns out to be 0 or 1. Is that enough? It's a hasty explanation. Yeah?
As far as in general, with these type of questions, what does this code do? Is there a way that you recommend going about it other than just throwing in samples and seeing how it reacts?
I think the easiest way to answer these questions generally is to look at the possible answers and seeing if it matches that pattern when we are helpful enough to give you multiple choice like this. There's a reason why we didn't do something evil like put a none of the above answer here, and that's why. And we'll try to avoid doing that because that would make the question a lot harder. Yeah?
I think so. You talked about the question about the flags.
Yeah.
That was on the post quiz.
Yeah. It's about the bottom.
It's on the post quiz. So I think the reason that there was a question about it was the answer was none of the above, but all the rest of the answers were about flags. So if you didn't know
yes.
that those flags weren't going to be changed, you didn't.
Yes.
You didn't realize that they were the same.
Yeah.
So like, you did have to sort of know about the flags. You had to know that they weren't different.
Yeah. Okay.
I have a quick question. So if I XOR A and B twice, if I do A XOR B and then A XOR B again, will I get A back or what?
If you do A XOR B XOR B,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Then you get A back.
Okay.
So XORing something with something twice undoes, yeah, itself. Because it's, remember, it's flipping bits. So if you flip bits twice, you get back the same thing.
Is there, by any chance, like a
shorter way to take the minimum with bitwise operation, or is this like the best way?
This is probably the shortest way. It's, I would note that this is a clever trick. It doesn't mean it's actually faster.
What's the like fastest way?
I mean, it's actually faster than like using a conditional. It might sometimes be, but don't assume that. Like, don't try to be clever unless you're actually like taking out a timer.
Is this how the min function works?
No. It probably uses a conditional because usually that's likely to be faster. There might be some cases where it's not, like if you can use bitwise operations, do lots of them at a time or something like that. Okay. Any other non-anonymous feedback? Okay, so let's then get into ISA. So I showed you a big list, I have one more. Yeah, I think we've covered things from last lecture, so no, I don't need to go there. So let's go into ISA. So I showed you a big list of ISAs that are still being made. And you might wonder, why do we need so many different ISAs? Why isn't everyone just happy with x86 or ARM? And there's lots of choices that were made in these ISAs that sort of reflect different ideas about what makes for a convenient to use instruction set and a convenient to implement instruction set. And we'll be looking at that with respect to the subset our textbook chose. So a bunch of the things they do make it easier to program in. So there's lots of instructions in x86 because there's lots of things that the chip manufacturers wanted to let people be able to do. And there's also questions about how many registers you have, which affects how complex your processor is to make, and how big it is, and how fast it is. There's also an issue of how you encode instructions. So some of these ISAs have variable length instructions. This means that maybe common instructions are only 1 byte long, so maybe an average instructions are shorter. And maybe you can easily fit something like an 8 byte constant in an instruction. Whereas with some of these other ISAs, like say MIPS, you can't, or PowerPC, you can't fit an 8 byte constant in an instruction. But all instructions are the same length, which makes things simpler for assemblers and for processors. And, you know, so. And I have some stars here. And also, these are sort of approximate counts because sort of accounting for these things is complicated. Like, I'm telling you that ARM7 uses 4 byte instructions, but that's not entirely true. I'm saying there's 1,500 instructions on x86-64, but this gets into questions like, is move immediate to register and move memory to register the same instruction? Is add 64-bit values and add 32-bit values the same instruction? It's a matter of opinion, and that's going to be true with all of these counts. So these are approximate. This gives you an idea that there's this big difference in complexity, and helpfully in this class, we have one of the simpler entries on this chart that you'll be implementing. You're probably happy not to have some number above 100 here, but that's not typically what happens. And the big divide that our textbook talks about in the sidebar, which maybe you read, is RISC versus CISC. That some of these are some sort of reduced, and I'll talk about what sort of things that means later, and tend to be simpler. And we can see some of that divide here. And we'll get into which parts of this chart show us that. Now there's a huge variety. So one of the obvious things they vary in is just what instructions they've chosen to provide, like just how many, and how many registers they provide. So we have our outlier Itanium, which has 128 general purpose integer registers. And then we have something like the Z80, which has 7. So obviously with very different sort of ideas about what's convenient to implement and how much stuff you want to put on the processor. So there's some other choices that I'd like to talk about because you haven't seen instruction sets that do certain things that are actually pretty common. And one of them is about condition codes. Yeah?
On the previous slide, why is the instruction set
instruction set for risk be highlighted?
Where?
Has a star next to it.
The which part?
No.
The 500 has a star because there are subsets of RISC-V which are much smaller and might be more commonly implemented. That's why I put a star there. So, yeah, I put stars in places where I thought the numbers are maybe a little deceptive. So another example of a choice we've seen is that I think all the instruction sets you've seen use condition codes. You may have not learned them as using condition codes, but you saw that you like could do test in JE or comp in JE. And that's the way you do branches. And that's why we're going to do it in Y86. That's how we do it in X86. But there's another choice that is very common among some instruction sets, which is to have something like a branch of equal instruction, which takes two registers and a label to go to. There's not any particular advantage to either one. There are arguments that we will be able to explain later in the semester for why you might prefer this form. There's some convenience to the flags because you get them for free from implementing arithmetic. You don't need as many extra instructions to do comparisons. But both of these choices are really implemented, and you might work with an instruction set where this is how conditional branches work. Yeah.
What does test do?
Test. So test is like comp is like sub, but doesn't store the result. Test is like XOR, but doesn't store the results. So you'll most commonly see it in x86 used to check if something is zero. So you test something, XOR something with itself, or sorry, it's not like XOR, sorry, it's like AND. You AND something with itself, see if it's zero with JE, which just checks with the zero flag, and that's a common pattern you'll see your compiler generate. Yes?
Well, if something is negative, would it also set something?
Yeah, so it will set the sign flag. So it's also the easy way to test if something is negative. Test is like AND, except it doesn't store the result. So another big variation is ways of specifying operands. So you've only seen x86, which has this pretty crazy choice to let you put four things every time you want to specify a memory location. And there are other crazy choices that are out there. So on ARM, you can specify a register shifted as an operand to almost any instruction. That's just supported in the instruction set that you can add R12 and R11 shifted over by 3. They just decided that was useful enough to do, that just like we allow you to add something to form an address, they allow you to shift a register over to form a value. And there have been instruction sets which have, let you say, this register contains a pointer to a pointer. So there's other options out there. Should be aware, you should not be surprised that they exist. I didn't show you the easy ones, like pretty much all instruction sets, like use a register or some simpler form of a memory location. But there's a variation in which ones are allowed. So another big choice that's commonly made is how many operands you have. So I think all the instruction sets you've seen are two operands at most, like source two, source one, and destination. That sort of syntax. There are also many instruction sets, quite common, where instructions take three operands. So what's an advantage of doing this? Yeah.
You need more things in one.
So the answer is you can do more things in one instruction. With x86, with two operands, you sometimes have to add and move instruction to do the same thing that you need to do. What's a disadvantage? Why would you not want to do this?
The instructions might be slow and take a lot of cycles.
So one idea is that maybe this makes the instructions slower. It's plausible, but it's probably not actually true. Any other ideas?
It makes the instructions more complex.
The main reason is probably the encoding, is that in order to encode this, you need to fit three operands in your instruction. So it's going to take up more space, and maybe you take more space to the code on your chip. So that's sort of the disadvantage of doing this, that you make your instructions bigger to do this roughly the same amount of stuff. But we've seen both choices exist out there. Yes?
So like in certain situations where they use like RISC chips in like mobile devices, but like in desktops they use like CISC chips, like why is it beneficial to use the reduced instruction sets in like smaller devices?
So we'll get to CISC versus RISC in a second. So the question was about why would we use CISC and not mobile devices. I guess I have a note here that VAX is an instruction set which happens to do both. They exist. Okay, which gives us into CISC versus RISC, CISC and RISC. So RISC stands for Reduced Instruction Set Computer. And there's a lot of controversy as to exactly what RISC means. I think the best way to understand RISC is to look at what it was a reaction to. It's reduced, so there must have been something that they wanted to reduce. What was that? And you might think that x86 is very complicated and does some very crazy things, but you probably don't actually know the instructions on x86, which really are what's complicated. So x86 has some very complicated instructions from a hardware implementation perspective. So these don't sound that complicated, but when we start implementing a processor, you'll realize that these are a lot of work to do in one instruction, relatively speaking. And the most notable thing is we have instructions that write multiple values. So we have push and pop, which write to multiple locations, like the stack pointer and something else. And we have even more weird instructions. So MoveSB is an instruction we will not use in this class, which copies a value from memory to another place in memory in one instruction. But x86 is actually relatively tame as far as having instructions that do complicated things like writing to two memory locations or reading from a memory location and writing to a memory location. And the real winner at the time that RISC came about was VAX. And VAX has some really, really complicated instructions. I'll pause for a minute so you can read the short description of these actual VAX instructions. Yes.
Does any compiler actually use these?
So the question is, does any compiler actually use these instructions? So VAX is very old. And at the time that VAX was popular, typically programs were written in assembly. And that is the big reason why you'd have instructions like this. These are very convenient if you're coding assembly. But these are really complicated instructions. Like each of these instructions appears to have a loop inside it, which is not something we've seen with any instruction in x86. And many of these instructions access an arbitrary amount of memory. And you might wonder, well, how do you implement these? But you don't even know how to implement simple things. But the implementation strategy for these instructions is actually a little strange. So these are the basic instructions in VAX, but not really. So, we have this instruction which has to do a loop in hardware to find a string in a string. And typically, the way it's implemented is that when the hardware for the VAX decoded this instruction, it actually looked up a sequence of what are called micro instructions. So there's this secret second instruction set that's used to implement the first instruction set. And this is what was popular at the time that RISC came about. Yes?
Doesn't that kind of defeat the purpose in coding in a low-level language like that if you're not actually, you still have to like interpret what you're writing and simplify it?
So this was the RISC argument. So the question is, doesn't it defeat the purpose in coding in a low-level language? You have to remember that at the time, assembly was the language you programmed in. Like, high-level languages were not yet very popular. Yeah?
So I guess two questions. One, so when you say this was written a long time ago, this is like before the invention of C, or like before,
So the question is, was this before C or Pascal? This is like the 70s. So probably before C. This doesn't mean it's before high-level languages. High-level languages like date back to like the late 50s, early 60s. But the wide adoption of them was different.
Okay, and then second, is this effectively just sort of like almost sort of like a macro of?
Yeah, so you can think of it as kind of a macro, but you never actually code in the micro instructions.
Okay.
And it would be typical for even quote unquote simple instructions to be multiple micro instructions. Like it would be an instruction to like look up something from a register or memory.
Okay, so it's like
micro instruction. Yeah.
Language.
Yeah.
Okay.
So RISC was a reaction to this and to that idea that why are we coding in this low-level thing, which isn't really the low-level thing. And the sort of observations that the RISC people had were that complex instructions were usually not actually faster than doing the same thing with the simpler instructions because it was basically the same microcode. It's not always true, but often true. And the big thing is that Samira talked about choosing instructions to be easy to implement. And complex instructions like this are really hard to implement. Like one thing you want to do when you ship a computer is you want to make sure that all the instructions do what your specification says. If your specification is that the instructions look for a string in another string, you have a lot more things to test than if your specification says add two numbers. And the other big difference is that as the time RISC came about, people were getting more confidence in compilers. So I guess another thing, I said that programming in high-level languages wasn't as popular, and part of this was that early compilers were really stupid and did not generate good assembly code. And that was becoming less true at the time RISC came about. People could trust compilers to do more work and generate more efficient code. So our textbook talks about some properties of RISC ISAs. I have my own list. I've deliberately omitted one thing the textbook talks about, which is the textbook says that RISC ISAs typically don't use condition codes. I don't think this is actually true if you look at what people call a RISC ISA. But there's not actually a hard line. So these are properties where if you see them, it's more likely to be something people would consider RISC. And if you don't see them, it wouldn't. But the only like real true example of like RISC is probably MIPS1. The only real true example of CISC that's definitely CISC is probably like the VAX. So one property is that they have fewer instructions. They don't implement these complex instructions. They just say, you're going to write that yourself using simpler instructions. They commonly have separate instructions to access memory. So rather than having every instruction be capable of talking to memory, a RISC ISA will typically say, there's a set of instructions for doing that. Otherwise, you're working on registers. And this simplifies the hardware a lot. They typically use fixed length instructions. This is about making the hardware simpler. So fixed length instructions means that encoding constants in your instructions is harder, but it makes the hardware easily be able to look ahead to a few instructions without needing to do any complex logic. They have more registers. So in exchange for this reduced complexity of the instructions, that means there's more room on the chip to put registers. And having more registers makes it easier to write fast programs using simple instructions. So RISC processors typically try to have more registers to compensate for not having complex instructions. Yes?
Didn't the previous slide have variable?
Yes. So that is the property which is not typical of a RISC ISA. So,
what does that say?
This is typical of a RISC ISA. So x86 and y86, in that sense, do not look like a RISC ISA. Yes?
So it's harder to encode constants in the instructions, but it's easier to encode registers. So like for example, my own question, I was saying, which of these can be done on one line in y86? Is that why being able to access like in memory at register plus register was correct, but register plus constant was like incorrect?
Yeah, so this was about actually this last point, fewer dressing modes. So in y86, to be more RISC-like, they chose to get rid of the register plus register addressing mode and only have register plus constant.
Okay.
And the constant is not, because y86 doesn't decide to use a fixed length encoding, the constant is actually pretty big.
Yeah.
But on a RISC, like a more RISC-like processor, you'd have a constant which might only be 16 bits or something. Okay, so more registers. So along with simpler instructions, so simpler is kind of vague, but you can pretty definitely say that a RISC processor is not going to have any instructions which dual loop inside them. That's just not going to be there. None of that string and string stuff. And a RISC processor is pretty much never, anything which has been called RISC will pretty much never have an instruction which reads and writes from memory in the same instruction. Whereas this was not uncommon on CISC-like processors. But as I said, this is a vague line. So these are typical properties, and you're not going to tip, if you look at any of those instruction sets I showed you, you're not actually going to find an easy way of saying yes or no for each of them. And everything's going to be pretty much in the middle, with the exception of a handful of like really clear examples, like VAX is clearly violates all of these, and MIPS 1, the first version of MIPS, pretty clearly fits into all of these. Okay. So with that, let's talk about our instruction set for the rest of this course. It's called Y86-64. It's in your textbook. It's based on XV6, but it omits most of the 1,000+ instructions. So, which is good, because you only have to implement these instructions. And a few of the instructions are going to be renamed from what X86 calls them. And also, the encoding is going to be much, much simpler. I'm not going to tell you in this class what the X86 real encoding is. I can tell you where to look it up if you like. But we're going to have a way simpler encoding that you will actually have to decode, so you'll be happy it's simpler. And so let's start by going through some of these changed instructions. So basically, it's just x86, but we got rid of all the other instructions but these. The CC here means something representing things based on condition code, like less than, greater than, or as it happens, an unconditional version. So JCC includes normal jump. That's just jump where we don't care what the condition codes are set to. Okay. So I mentioned here that move Q is renamed. And it's in fact renamed into multiple names. So the names take this form where we have a letter representing the type of the source, a letter representing the type of the destination, and it's either immediate, meaning a value in the instruction itself, register, or a value in memory. And we can't actually do some of these. So moving to an immediate, a constant in the instruction, doesn't make sense. So those don't exist. And it turns out we just won't implement moving an immediate directly to memory. We're just not going to have that instruction. Or moving from memory to memory. We're just not going to have that instruction. Yes?
Can you define immediate?
Immediate is a value, a constant in the instruction. It's called immediate because it's right there when you look for it. So these are, so IR move Q, RR move Q, MR move Q, and RR move Q are the variants of move we'll have. Every other kind of move doesn't exist. Questions? Yes?
So those top are the ones with the X's, they exist, but we don't do them?
They could, these ones are plausible, but they don't exist in the instruction set. Like, we could have added them. We couldn't have added II move Q. But we could have added im move q, but we didn't.
So if you want to put a constant in some place in memory, you have to put it in the register first or in some place in memory and then?
Yeah, so the question is, if you want to put a constant in memory, I have to put it in the register first? Exactly. So the simplest way to put a constant in memory is to move it to a register, then move that register to memory. Okay, so another one that's up here is cmoveCC. So this represents a set of instructions that exist in x86 that you've probably never seen. So I'm going to go over them. So they're conditional moves. So they're like a register-to-register move. In real x86, they might be, they're a more general move, I think. I'm not sure. But in y86, it's only register to register, and they only move if the condition code matches something. So rather than skipping over a move with a JLE, you can use a conditional move. So this is move if greater. And it's based on some comparison you did before.
You
have to do the compare before this. And I note that we don't have a comp or a test instruction, but as we learned last time, every arithmetic instruction sets condition codes. So if you want to do a comparison, you need to do one of these arithmetic instructions and you take advantage of that setting those flags. So we also have this HLT instruction. That's another one you probably haven't seen. So there, the x86-64 instruction is called HLT. In y86-64, we don't have a vowel shortage, so we call it halt. And it stops the processor. Otherwise, the processor would keep going. Whatever's in memory is going to fetch the next instruction, keep running it. So we need to want to have a way to stop the processor. So this exists on real processors, but it's typically reserved for the operating system. It's not something user programs are allowed to do. But you're going to implement it because we want your processor to have a way to stop. Okay. So I told you that there were instructions for accessing memory. And I mentioned addressing mode. So in x86, we have this really complex way of specifying memory operands. In y86, this is how you specify a memory operand: displacement and register. Everything else that you can do in x86 is not valid. Everything with two registers or a scale, not valid. You cannot do it, it just doesn't exist. Yes? So it just doesn't exist. So if you want to do that, you need to compute the address in another way. Yes?
I was about to ask, what would other ways be?
So if you want to do, for example, R12 and R13, you could add R12 and R13 before and then use this form.
So if you wanted to do the last line where it's like multiply, add.
Yes.
You have to use like four lines.
You have to use a whole bunch of lines to do. The question is, how do I do this last version? Yeah, you have to do a whole bunch of lines to do that.
How's multiplication done in y86?
There is no multiply instruction. You need to figure out a different way. The question is how multiplication is done. Yeah, you can't. There isn't an instruction for it. You'll have to implement it with adds or something. Okay, so another issue is accessing memory on other instructions. So the move instructions that access memory are the only instructions that access memory, access data memory. The other instructions access instructions, right? They're not the only instructions. Only instructions besides push and pop and call and write. But normal instructions that take registers do not access memory. You cannot say add a value in memory to a register. If you want to do this, what do you do instead? So yeah, we need to get this value in a register first. So we move, then add. That's the alternative there. And someone mentioned that, how do I do this? So can anyone tell me what the alternative for how you actually convert this into valid Y86 code. So yeah, some I guess there.
You can like just add, add R11 like 8 times.
Okay.
And then do a move from memory to register and then do the add.
Yeah, so the idea is that you're going to add R11 to itself something like 8 times. That would be the simplest thing. There's a little easier way, which, yeah. So you want to shift it. So shifting it would be a great idea. Shifting is multiplying by 8, shifting by 3. Unfortunately, not on the list. So there is no shift instruction. But there is something very similar, which is that multiplying by 2 is adding something to itself, which is shifting over by 1. So if you multiply it by 2 3 times, that's shifting multiplying by 8. And that's probably the simplest way of doing it. Yes?
Are you allowed to write proof, or are you allowed to have like subroutines that you can go to, or like multiply?
So we have call and ret. So those exist. You can write functions.
How would you do divides?
How would you do divides? That's not something we're going to talk much about how to do efficiently. The simplest thing is you can do repeated subtraction. There's obviously somewhat better ways for doing it. It is possible to do. And we will not have you implement it. Okay, and as I mentioned, we have a move from an immediate to a register. This is the only instruction with a non-address constant operand. There are instructions which take an address, like jump and call, but non-address constants, this is the only instruction which takes it. So if you want to add 1 to a number, no, you can't do that way. You instead need to get 1 in the register and then add it. So this is going to make writing Y86 a little harder. But it's, on the other hand, it's going to make implementing it easier. And you're going to do a lot more implementing Y86 than writing Y86. Yes?
On the previous slide, you moved R11 to R11. Why'd you do that?
I moved memory at 10 plus R11 to R11.
Can you not just do the 10 parentheses R11 for the add?
That is right. That is also not valid. So the way to remember what you can do for each instruction is this simple rule. There is only one kind of value for each operand in Y86. So if you can put a register in some place without parentheses, that is the only thing you can put there ever. And this is why we split move into 4 different names. This means that move now follows this rule, because IR move Q tells you what each of the operands have to be. Yes?
In the book was, in order to differentiate between them, that was the second half of the byte, right?
We will get to that in a second. Okay. Yes?
Did you say that IR move Q is the only command that doesn't have an address as an operand?
That has a non-address constant as an operand.
Every other command has an address.
Every other command which takes a constant, that constant is an address. Obviously, that or part of an address, like an immediate a displacement. Okay. So we also have condition codes. In this course, we will only be using ZF and SF. We will ignore all other condition codes. And they're set by all arithmetic and logic, and not by anything else. And I'll probably... And you notice from, and so this gives us this sort of summary chart. So it's set by the result of the operation. And one way of thinking about it is that we're comparing the result to zero, and that's how you can think of what the less than less and so on means. And we're missing overflow and carry flag. So we just don't handle some cases. We don't handle overflow. We're not gonna have you handle overflow. Our book handles overflow. You are not gonna handle overflow in the assignments. But this is sort of summary, and sign flag is set based on whether the result of something is negative. The zero flag is set based on whether it's zero. And remember that sub goes in the wrong order. Okay. And we don't have comp and test, so you're going to do normal arithmetic. So any questions about sort of condition codes, how they're going to work, Y86? So this is simpler, but we can actually give you this chart sanely and not have you panic. You should be able to figure it out, and it's in your textbook. You just ignore everything with OF. Yeah.
So like, if you're gonna basically like do comp with a subtract, you have to like, without like changing the registers, you have to like back up the register in another register, and then like do the subtraction.
Yeah. So the question is, I want to do comp without changing a register. I need to back up the value of the register. Yes. Yeah.
For greater than or equal and greater than, are they flipped? Because shouldn't greater than or equal also check the zero flag?
This is NZF is unset. Greater than, it's checking for not zero. So we don't care if ZF is zero or one for greater than or equal.
So greater than or equal doesn't check whether they're equal?
Yeah, it doesn't explicitly check that. It just doesn't check whether it's unequal or equal. And test is and. And a reminder that push and pop takes the value that's at the stack pointer, push puts something below where the stack pointer is. Hopefully you remember this from earlier. We will remind you, like on tests, because it's a common confusion, that this is how things work. So the way I remember this myself is that where the stack pointer points is on the stack. And colon ret does a push, pushes a program counter, ret pops a program counter, pops into the program counter. So, and call, in addition to pushing the program counter on the stack, jumps to, is a jump. So this is our state in Y86-64. So we talked about processor state last time, and we're simplifying this slightly. So we got rid of the overflow and carry flags. We actually get rid of one of the registers, so R15 doesn't exist. And we have the program counter again in memory, and we have this other register you'll see called stat, which is whether the processor is halted or not. So that's my review of the Y86 instruction set from the perspective of how does assembly work. Yeah?
Do the registers have the same name as in X86? Or?
Yes. So the question is, do the registers have the same name? Yes. There are no shorter registers. They're all 64-bit. But all of them, the 64-bit ones, have the same name. Yes?
What's the command to start the processor after it's halted?
We will not have a command. The question is, how do you start the processor after it's halted? We're not going to allow that. Okay, so if we look over the instructions we have, so YD6 has some of these properties, so they're separate instructions to access memory, some things we expect of these RISC instruction sets, these reduced instruction sets, that make it simpler to implement. We have no looping instructions, no instructions that access memory twice, and we don't have very many addressing modes. We have one way to specify a memory address, and one way to specify a normal arithmetic operand, namely a register. And one way to specify a label to jump to, which is going to end up being encoded as an address in the instruction. Whether we have fewer instructions or more registers is debatable, but we definitely don't have fixed length instructions. So Y86 is kind of a more RISC-like version of X86. is one way you can think about it. So x86 is more on the SIX side of things, more on that complex instruction set computer. This is more on the RISC side of things, but it's still not really like fully RISC. So any questions about this? So the other reason we're using a subset is so we can have an encoding. And this is a reproduction of a table from the book with the instruction encoded. So on this chart, these are the byte numbers. So some instructions are 1 byte, some are up to 10 bytes. In this chart, the first part is the high order bits of a byte. The second part is the low order bits. And we can see that the instructions, based on their mnemonic, have a different high order bit. I will call this the opcode of the instruction. The book calls it sometimes the I code. And this tells you which mnemonic it is, except that all the arithmetic operations have one opcode, all the types of jumps and conditional moves have one opcode. So for these things which are grouped together under one opcode, the next part of that first byte, the low order bits, are used for a secondary opcode, which tells you what kind of thing it is. And the conditional move is grouped with the non-conditional move, and the conditional jumps are grouped with the non-conditional jump. And the way we tell it's not conditional is that the secondary opcode, which the book calls FN, the function code, is 0, meaning always do this. Otherwise, it's L, LEL, and so on, which is going to be based on the condition codes, based on that chart I showed you earlier. So that's conditional opcodes for things which use condition codes, the secondary opcode, the function code. We also have a function code for arithmetic, and we just have this fixed chart about whether it's add, subtract, and or XOR. So after the opcode and possibly a function code, which tells us what the name of the instruction is, we have the instruction's operands. And we take up a variable amount of space based on how many operands there are. So NOP and HALT don't have any operands, so after the opcode, we're done. Same with RET. Some instructions take register operands. And for those, we're going to have a byte with up to 2 register numbers. And we have this table, which is in your book. I will never expect you to memorize it, about what register number is what register. And we got rid of R15, and that's actually reserved for a register number meaning 9. And so for instructions which only take one register, we will not include that spot. And some instructions take an immediate value, take a constant in the instruction. And that's going to be encoded always in 8 bytes, always in little endian, afterwards. So for our instructions which access memory, they take a displacement. In Y86, that displacement is 8 bytes, it's in little endian, and it's after the register numbers. Some instructions that jump to a location take the address to jump to, either both call and jump do this. And that destination address is 8 bytes, it's a constant in the instruction, and it's encoded in little endian order. And it's immediately after the opcode because there's no registers we need to include in the instruction. So any questions about anything on this chart? Yes?
Can I use the IR move key instead of the conditional one? You set the condition code to 0?
Yes. So 0 basically means always. So you can think of RR move Q as C move always. Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
So from this diagram, the machine knows from the first bit straight out like how to delineate between the different sections.
Yes, so there's a quiz question on this. So the first byte tells you exactly what kind of instruction it is. And that's what you're going to do, is you're going to look at these high order 4 bits of the first byte, and that's how you're going to determine where the next instruction is and what fields you need to actually use when you implement the processor.
Okay.
So let's look at an example of encoding something for all the way from assembly, from converting from x86 assembly all the way to something encoded in y86. So first of all, what in this assembly, this x86 assembly, can I not do in y86? So back there. So adding this constant to a register. So to fix that, we had this pattern before that I'm going to load that constant directly into a register. So an example implementation is I put 1 in RAX, then add RDI to RAX. So here's my, and I also couldn't use move queue because that doesn't exist. Instead, we have one of the versions, in this case, IRMoveQ. So now let's go about encoding this. And you can just go through instruction by instruction and take that table and take one row from it and just use it as a template. So if we look at that template, the first thing it says is that the high order bit is 3 for the opcode, high order 4 bits, followed by a 0 for the function code slot because the IR move queue instruction does not share its opcode with any other instruction. And then we have this fixed F in the first register slot because there's two registers and the encoding chose to not put one of the registers there in the first slot and to use the second slot instead. And then we need to somehow put the register number for RAX because that's the destination. And it's followed by the constant, which we're going to represent in little endian as an 8-byte number. So we look up in the table what RAX is, and you'll find out it's 0. And so this is the encoding you get. You get so hex 30, hex F0, then 01, 00, 00, and so on. This is how it actually turns out to be in binary. That sequence of bytes. Then we can go on to the next instruction. We look up in our table. AddQ falls under OpQ. It's one of the arithmetic operations. So it has 6 for the opcode. And we need a function code for that. So you need whatever the function code for add is. And we have these two registers in our table. It tells us where they go in the instruction. And we need to look up those register numbers. So once you fill in the blanks, sometimes you need to look up what add is or RDI is in the table. It's mechanical, then you fill in the slot with the values you find in that table. You get an actual encoding. Finally, we have our last instruction, RET, which is the easiest one because in the table it just says it's 90, and that's it. Yes?
Address,
right? So the question is, what does return do? Go to a specific address. So return goes to the address it reads from the stack. So we don't need to supply it any operands. It just always reads from the stack.
Oh, so the hardware.
Yeah. So yeah, it doesn't. You don't need to give it RSP because it always uses RSP. And when you've done this, you can write this down as a sequence of bytes, and this is what would actually appear in memory. Question?
Do you not use call? Isn't that part of the opcode?
I would, this code doesn't use call.
Okay, but it's in
there. There is a call instruction, we just don't have it in this assembly snippet.
What's the F before the 0 in the first instruction?
The F, why is there an F here is the question. So if we look at our encoding here, we have this slot where in other instructions there's a register number, and the makers of this encoding decide to always put an F, which is the none register there. This is going to make it easier to implement the instruction set. We could have put anything there, but putting an F there will make it easier on us, and that's why they chose to say you have to put an F there. So, which 15.
Yeah.
So, right. that example. So let's go through an example with a jump to show the other option. So here's, well, so this add instruction is we've seen before. We have our three blanks, one for the function code, two for the register numbers. We look up what those are. And then we have this jump if greater than. And we have a label here. But the way we're going to encode our instructions is that this needs to become the address. So we need to know where this address is in going to be in memory, which ordinarily the linker would do. Yes?
Is this one of those things where it's relative or where you have the actual?
So in this case, the address is an absolute number. So for those of you who know what relative addresses are, we're not going to use them in y86. All addresses are going to be the actual memory address. We're going to load that directly into the program counter. So let's say, hypothetically, that this is at address hex 123 in memory. Then we're going to write that hex 123 as a little endian integer in the instruction after we have the opcode. And that should be a 0, not an F. I apologize for the error. But the way we encode this address is as the actual memory address number in little endian form. Okay. Any questions about decoding? Yes.
Why would it be 0 out of F?
Because that's what the table says. That's all. Yeah. Shouldn't it 2301? Yes, it should be 2301.
One and two.
This is what I get for, yeah, it should be 2301.
Shouldn't it be 3012?
So the question is, shouldn't it be 3012? No, it's little endian, so the least significant part is first. So the bottom two parts are 23. The bottom byte is 23. The least significant byte is 23. So that is definitely first, but yes, I meant to put 01. I will correct this slide before I post it. Any other questions? Yes.
So why do you have the 0 at the end there? Is that just saying like there would be zeros all the way?
That's just misaligned.
Oh.
So do I have
so
actual? Yeah. Okay. So, and you can, I think you can go through how you decode y86. It's, again, you have your table. You look at the opcodes. So you find this opcode 2. You say, oh, that's 2 bytes. So the next opcode is that 6, and so on. And then you just go through, line everything up with the table, and say, oh, this is the V in there. That's just the RB. And that, and so it's a very mechanical process, one you should get practice with, because if we give you a table like this in the other tables, we expect you to be able to do this.
So all the ones with the green, if the actual media is less than that, it still takes up the entire space. Right?
So the question is, these things with the green that represent immediate values or addresses, do they always take up 8 bytes? Yes. Always 8 bytes, no exceptions. Doesn't matter how big it looks in assembly. Okay. And before I finish up, a final word about why the instruction set looks the way it does, which might help you remember things. So a lot of this is designed to be convenient for you as a hardware implementer. So we have 4 bits to encode the instruction size and layout. So figuring out how big an instruction is and where the fields are is simple. So that's a choice that was made to make the hardware simpler. So even though it's variable length, at least it's an easy to figure out variable length. We have mostly uniform placements of operands. So the first register number is always in the same place. A register number we write to is almost always in the same place. A register number we use with an address is always in the same, to compute an address, I should say, is always in the second slot. So there's some logic behind where things are placed, even though you probably are going to have to look things up in the table to remember which is RB, which is RA. Jumping to zeros, so what would typically be uninitialized memory halts the machine. This is a feature. It's better than jumping to zeros doing something. So on x86, if you jump to zeros, that's a whole bunch of memory, adds to a value in memory. And there's no attempt in here to fit things tighter than 1 byte. So everything separated by bytes, because memory is an array of bytes. We could have tried to do something funny where we say, oh, you know, halt doesn't really need to a whole byte. But we didn't do that. This makes the hardware simpler. Because our PC doesn't need to have this sort of fractional part. So any questions about anything y86 before we go? So next time, Samira will be talking about how we implement this.
So, for